All right, welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, and we have another excellent episode of Scout Talk with Russ Landy. Russ, always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much, Matt. So excited about this. I was actually telling our good friend Mike Tanya that he needed to check out our podcast and give us some thoughts. So always love getting on here and getting to talk football with one of my favorite people in the business.
Oh, man, well, much appreciated. And likewise with you, you know, this has been a lot of fun for us to do. And let's just get right into it and talk a little bit about some guys from the draft who, you know, I thought it'd be fun today to discuss guys that maybe you liked who were either drafted later or signed as an undrafted free agent who you think might need a team or two before they can really get their footing as a contributor or maybe even as a starter down the line.
Well, you know, I'm going to give you, I got two first rounders and two later round guys. So okay. The first rounder, the weird one to me is because I love him as a player, but it's Isaiah Simmons. And that's really because I think that, and we talked about it, I think a little bit, is that he's a unique player. He's not a guy that you can sort of pigeonhole in one spot and say that's where he's going to be a star, or at least that's what I anticipate, is you have to move him around. But because there's unknown, and because you can't point to him playing 90% of his snaps in college at one position and seeing the positives and negatives, there's going to be a learning curve. And historically, if you look at the last 20 years, any player that has a real learning curve and really needs to be contorted and twisted and manipulated that ends up in a disaster of an organization like Arizona or Jacksonville or something like that, usually it doesn't work out very well. So my guess is that Isaiah is going to go there and they're going to try a variety of things. And it's not that their coaches aren't good. I just think that sometimes the pressure of winning when you've been losing over and over and over leads you to force things and rush things. I just think this is a guy who's probably going to have some flashes of greatness, but real ups and downs in Arizona. And I think either he will leave or they will end up with a new coaching staff there. And that may precipitate maybe him sort of being them able to figure out after 3 or 4 years of being used in different spots to find the right way to use him.
Nice. Who's your second guy?
My second guy, and this is the one you and I have talked about a ton, and that's Jordan Love. And
yeah.
I don't think it's him, but here's what I look at. Is it's really going to come down to sort of the courageousness of the head coach LaFleur and the GM Gutekunst, which is, you know, Aaron Rodgers is probably, although he's had some ups and downs in recent years statistically, some people will tell you know he's going to come back and probably have one of the best years of his career this year. Because he's the type of guy that if he feels slighted, he's going to do everything in his power to sort of shove it up your butt. So I think he's going to come back this year. They're going to win 13, 14, 12 games, somewhere in there, because he's going to play so well. So assume they do that, and then the next year after that they win 11 or 12. Is that GM and head coach combination going to feel confident enough in their job security to say, we've won the division 3 years in a row, we've been to the playoffs, we're ready to whack this guy to install our unknown quarterback, and in the hope that they think, well, we've won enough, the ownership committee isn't going to fire us. But at the same time, because you're getting rid of him in all those winning seasons, maybe they look at you and say you're crazy and they do fire you. That's why I think they say, you know what, if they go to the playoffs the next 2 years, I really believe Jordan Love is going to be a guy that gets traded. Because in this business, turnover, people get fired so often that if you're winning, and if they're winning 12, 13 games a year with Rodgers, and he's still playing at a high level, they are out of their minds to bench him or trade him to play Love. That doesn't mean if he were to get hurt and end his career, you wouldn't let Love replace him. But he's too good to just shove out of the way if he's still carrying that team to the playoffs.
Nice. Here's my two, and I'll give you an early round guy and a mid round guy to begin with. My early round guy, I'm afraid it's going to be Denzel Mims with the New York Jets. And the reason I say that is when I look around at the New York roster, you know, I think roster construction is very important and what you have on the depth chart is important for young players. And do you have a veteran in place in addition to a good coach? And they certainly have the coach. You know, they have a good wide receiver coach in Sean Jefferson, who's been around the league and has been known as a good teacher, which you don't always get out of position coaches because, you know, a lot of times they're focused on scheme. They haven't always played the position that they're teaching. And it's a lot about scheme and game plan. But Jefferson's the type of guy that could probably give you, say, hey, look, this is what you need to do extra. Here's what you need to work on each day. Here's how you need to go about doing it. But who's the guy that's going to lead by example there? Is it Jamison Crowder, who's a more of a, might be their most proven player. He's more of a slot receiver. Quincy Enunwa, who's promising, but had to work on, you know, he basically had to work every day on a jugs machine just to get his hands right. And he may not even be able to play again with the neck injury.
Exactly.
So now you're looking at Rashad Perriman, who just escaped the clutches of career death, basically by being able to come back with Cleveland and then emerge as the third man in Tampa. But he's going to have to assume really what's going to be Mims's role if Mims develops. Yep. And then after that, you have Josh Doctson, who's been described as mega talented, but doesn't have the dog in him that loves football, at least according to, yep, you know, a lot of Washington observers. So you look around at this depth chart, and to me, it seems like Denzel Mims is in a sink or swim situation where it's like, does the gravity of the peers on his depth chart suck him down? And he's like, I made it, I'm pretty good, but not really having the perspective to understand how good he could actually be and what he needs to do to get there. Or is he going to rise above that and be the guy who works his tail off, does everything different than from the rest of the guys, you know, on the Jets depth chart, and actually emerges as their top threat early on? And I think that's where the fear for me is, that gravitational pull might be compelling enough that it keeps him down a little bit.
I couldn't agree more, because I think about it also as Doctson and Perriman are both first round picks who really struggled. And they, if you think those guys are going to be helping anybody, their entire focus is going to be, how do I make this roster? Because they've already struggled to establish themselves. So the odds, and it's not a knock on them personally, but the odds of them being able to contribute a lot as a leader mentor this year is going to be hard, because they're both focused on establishing themselves. I think the hard part, you mentioned Sean Jefferson. I mean, this guy played the position, coached the position. He's not only going to have to coach the finer points, teach all the stuff about the schemes. He's really, for Mims, going to almost have to also be that mentor, leader, receiver, which is a hard role for a position coach to fill, because he's doing so many other things. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's a very tough spot for Mims to be in, because you really like him to have at least one veteran guy, and maybe Crowder can be that guy, but he's such a different receiver. He may be able to teach him the off-field traits and work habits, but I don't know how much he's going to be able to help him on the field.
Yeah, and there's my second guy, same position, similar situation, much better team seemingly, and that's Brandon Ayuk, because – you have Wes Welker as the position coach, but then let's look at all the receivers. The reason that the 49ers had success on offense down the stretch is they looked around and said, we need someone who can get off press. We need someone who can run a complete route tree. We need someone who can be where he's supposed to be for Jimmy Garoppolo, especially on those chain moving tight coverage, you know, play altering or game altering drives. Who was that guy? Oh, Emmanuel Sanders. What did they do? They let him go. He's now with the Saints.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So now you have Kyle Shanahan, the resident genius, and certainly, you know, that's how he's portrayed. And certainly he does a lot of great things with his offense. But here we are, and we have, you know, we don't have a single receiver who you would classify as a wily or wizened veteran. The closest thing is Kendrick Bourne, who scrapped his way up the depth chart and is still really a young guy and more of a big slot type of player. And the rest of the guys are 3 years or less. And it's like, and when you look at that, one of them, who I had rated as the number one receiver in that class, didn't work hard enough last year, and Dante Pettis and Kyle Shanahan was, you know, basically like, I think this guy has the talent to be one of the best in the league, but he didn't apply himself, and he basically was in the doghouse all year. And there were even talks about trading him, but now the current face of, you know, to the media is Shanahan hasn't given up on him and still expects him to, you know, do something this coming year. And that may very well be the case, but it's going to have to happen, because he's the closest thing to Emmanuel Sanders on that roster.
Yep.
Ayuk is a very good double move off coverage receiver who can make plays after the catch and make returns for you. But when I see the analysis out there for, like, here's what he does and Emmanuel Sanders does well: he runs slants, he runs crossing routes, he runs double moves. And I'm looking at all of those and I'm going, that's great, but I have not seen a single piece of film in these how he fits, where he's beating press man coverage and he's running timing routes that are like longer than 5 yards. And I'm thinking it's those 1 to 2 plays a game that Emmanuel Sanders would convert that actually make the difference in these games. It's not the 5 or 6 targets that Brandon Ayuk's going to have in common with him. And so I look at this and go, same deal. How's he going to develop?
And it's a tough spot because, I mean, I think everybody would agree that Kyle is a very creative coach. And maybe what we're going to see, and this is my hope, because I like the IU kid. I think there's a lot of talent there to work with. Is Kyle smart enough to say, okay, maybe he doesn't do all the things we're ideally looking for at that spot perfectly. So can we tweak what we're asking at that spot to fit his skill set? Because if you can get him the ball to where he can take advantage of his ability to make plays when he has the ball in space and run after the catch, because he's a strong kid, he's athletic, then if you can do that and take advantage of that, will still open up the field. But it's going to be a very different way of opening up the field than what Sanders does. Sanders is sort of lightning in a bottle. He's explosive. He can get away from people. But he's not that big dynamic. I mean, they're just different players. And this will be a test for Shanahan's ability to adapt his offense. And we'll find out if he's willing to or if he tries to sort of force a square peg into a round hole.
Yeah, and I think he will, because when you look at the run game, when he had Tevin Coleman, you know, we've talked about this, I think, in the past, is when Tevin Coleman started off with Atlanta, he was an outside zone runner at Indiana, but he wasn't a very good outside zone runner.
No.
and you could see that as evidenced by, like, everyone would cite the Ohio State game, who was in the media, and say, well, he had 170 yards. And I said, he gained about 150 of them on 3 carries.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he couldn't read the holes for the rest of them. And then he comes to Atlanta. And they had, and Kyle Shanahan was smart enough after about 3 or 4 games ago, let's put some gap plays into the mix here and say, just hit that hole, son.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And I think and they've started, So they started doing that in San Francisco a little bit more with their run game. They do a little bit of a mix of things rather than just pure outside zone. So I'm hoping they'll do the same thing with their receivers, even though, you know, and as long as, you know, Ayuk's willing to work, then there you go. I'm gonna lead off with one, and we'll trade off like our last two back and forth here.
But, okay.
You know, one of the players for me also that's kind of more of a mid round guy is Bryson Hopkins of the Rams, the tight end out of I believe it was Purdue. Out of Vanderbilt, Purdue. Excuse me, Purdue. Yep. That's right, Purdue. I was thinking about his dad up in Tennessee, I guess, but. But Bryson is one of those players that when you watch him, you see some really nice evidence of really good hand-eye coordination, being able to be fluid in terms of body control to make catches, excellent first step and change of direction burst, like the type of guy that you feel like you get him out in the flats and he's going to move the chains for you almost immediately with the type of burst that he has. And I think that he has enough fundamental skills to be able to block and develop into a competent blocker at the H-back position. But when I look at the Rams, you know, after they have Tyler Higbee, they have Gerald Everett, certainly the contract situation may change for Everett and they may plug in Hopkins there. And this team is moving more to 2 tight end sets, but I'd have to think that Hopkins is a guy who, you know, it takes a little bit of time to develop, and he does have some issues where he drops the ball at times. So if he, I could see where if he doesn't start off fast for the Rams, he could wind up in a situation where, you know, he's looking for a job elsewhere, and he'll have to overcome the reputation of that he drops the football. And if he can do that, I think he could latch on some elsewhere and wind up having a decent career as that second tight end, or maybe even a lead tight end, you know, that wants to emphasize his pass catching if he can get over that hump of the initial drops.
You know, he was one of the guys I almost picked for this because I just look at him as a guy that he didn't boom onto the scene at Purdue. He was sort of a gradual guy each year. He contributed more and more and became a better player, still had the issues with drops, but they were less frequent as he got going, but still more than is acceptable to be a starting tight end in the NFL. And I also look at where he's going. I mean, you look back a few years back, the Rams go to the Super Bowl, everybody's excited. Sean McVay's a genius. Jared Goff is the greatest quarterback in the country, whatever you want to call it. But last year wasn't so hot. And I can tell you 100%, there's definitely some nervousness about if we don't get this ship turned around quickly, in a brand new stadium in LA, there may be 1 year or two where McVay stays there if they keep losing. Well, if that's the case, it's unlikely someone who needs time to develop and who does have some dropping issues is going to get that time and the patience to work his way into a role. If they get rid of Everett because of cap, or even if they don't, they just need a third guy who can step in and play a lot, he could get forced in sooner than he's ready for. To me, he's the guy that you almost don't want on the field this year. You want him to adjust to the pro game, work on the little things to make sure he becomes more consistent catching the ball. But if there's pressure to win and they have guys that need to be subbed out or they make salary cap moves, I think he could get rushed. And then 2 years down the road, if they're still losing and they bring in a new coach, he's the type of guy who I could see getting swept out pretty quickly, because if he's not a full-time starter making a big impact, it's probably because he's dropping balls. So if the new coaches come in and look at the film, I say, God dang, why is he dropping it? And they're just like, yeah, it doesn't hurt my rep to cut their former draft pick, and they just whack him. So, yeah, I agree. Yeah. That's a great choice of a guy that couldn't – it's not an ideal situation for him. And I'll give you one that is sort of similar – although different position, everything is John Greener, the defensive end out of Florida who went to the Houston Texans. And the reason I look at this guy as a guy that could be an issue is not that he's as physically gifted, but when you watch the film of him at Florida and you talk to the scouts, all you hear is immensely gifted, should be a double-digit sack guy every year at Florida, has the talent to be an all-pro in the NFL, doesn't compete every down like it's the end of the world, doesn't have the greatest technique. And it just makes me think, didn't Jadeveon Clowney just leave there a few years ago because the coach there couldn't stand that sort of inconsistency? And it just makes me wonder that, hey, maybe because this kid didn't go in the first round like he thought he was, maybe that opened his eyes. But if he's still the same inconsistent guy in the pros that he was at Florida, I could see this being a guy that ends up in the doghouse quickly. And maybe he needs to end up in a situation where – he can slowly learn from some other players. Now, the good thing he does have going is you have a J.J. Watt, you have a Whitney Merciless, you have some veterans there who are going to take him under their wing, but that didn't change Clowney a whole lot. So, to me, it's a tough situation. I think it's 50-50 for him there because he is such a good player in terms of pure talent, but the production is so inconsistent, and they just have not fared well with guys who don't have a consistent motor in Houston under Bill O'Brien.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. You know, and it's funny because it is when you start talking about guys in terms of it's that whole, well, we love the talent, but can they put it together? Can they be the professional? Can they be the worker? Can they learn fast, as you know, and with the type of offseason we had, you also have to wonder if it links back to how much information did they get on the player? How well do they know that guy? You know, and that's something I know we're going to talk about in a little bit here. One of the guys that I just look at and I think he's a very nice talent, but he's on a loaded depth chart right now, and that's Baltimore Raven UDFA signee Tyson Williams, who's the BYU back, who by way of South Carolina, who tore his ACL in early October in a Pac-12 game. And he should be ready by July, but you have, you know, Mark Ingram, J.K. Dobbins, Justice Hill, and Gus Edwards. And really what's funny is probably the most talented guy who was on their depth chart behind Mark Ingram at that, you know, this time last year, who's now with the Jets, is Kenneth Dixon, who just hasn't been able to stay healthy or be able to, you know, be a guy that felt like they could rely on probably off the field at times too. So Williams is this guy who's going to have to show that he's fully recovered, you know, by July or August. And then with a limited exposure that he probably will have with the current environment that we're in, I could just see how maybe he gets put on PUP. Maybe they save him and give him a chance for next year. But with, you know, if they keep Ingram, and I can see how this goes either way. Like I could see how Mark Ingram, you know, he's at his deal pretty much has an out at the end of this year. If they'll probably try to renegotiate with him. And if Ingram's wise, I could see him going, you know, I've had a pretty darn good career, but I've never won a Super Bowl. This is my chance to to actually do that here. We're in a window. I can be, you know, part of a committee. Maybe I'll take I'll renegotiate my contract to a team, you know, a helpful deal to the team and yep. take a cut and stick around. But if he doesn't do that and says, you know, I want more money and I'm going to walk, I can go somewhere else. And maybe they have a shot to win and they need me more. Then I could see a guy like maybe, you know, Williams getting a shot to compete, though he'll probably have to deal with another draft pick at that point too. So, you know, for him, I could see how he winds up somewhere else and has to try and work his way up.
I couldn't agree more. When you look at him in his situation, you almost think he's sort of battling right now to be one of the two if they keep two running backs on the practice roster. And that's really where he's sitting is, how do I prove myself enough that I'm healthy and good enough that I can stick on the PR so that they can look at me for a whole year so that a year from now they can figure out, do we want to renegotiate with Ingram or are we ready to move on and move everybody up a notch on the depth chart? Maybe I can get that last spot and slowly work my way up from there. But it's definitely a tough position, because the one thing I'll give Ingram a lot of credit for is, while he may not have ever become the superstar a lot of people had hoped he would, he has been a good, solid back a number of years, a very smart kid. And I think he's going to look at it and say, okay, with Lamar Jackson at quarterback, this is a running team. So even if I'm part of a committee and I'm not the guy, I'm going to get my 10, 12 touches a game. By being part of a committee, I'm not going to get broken in half, and I will still have a job, which a lot of veteran running backs, that doesn't happen once you're 28. I could see Ingram saying, you know what, I'm making whatever it is, 4.5 now. How about you give me 1.8 or 2, and I'll sign a 4-year deal with most of it if you guarantee me the first 2 years, because that'll pretty much get him three years. Well, shoot, then that puts Williams in a real tough spot. So it is no doubt a tough spot where I could see his second team really being a beneficial place, especially Ingram's not a younger guy anymore. In the preseason, they're going to cut his carries. So Williams will get some touches, a chance to impress people. So I agree with you. He's a guy in a tough spot. And my last guy is a small school kid, late round pick, Ben Bartsch out of St. John's. Missed an offensive lineman, immensely gifted, went to the Senior Bowl and held his own. But when you think about St. John's, and for those people that don't know, I mean, this is as low-level Division III as you're going to get. They don't cut anybody from their football team. They have one of the great winning traditions in college football. But you're talking about non-contact practices, low-level football. He's not going to get any off-season program in the NFL, so he's not going to really get coached his first year. He's also going to an organization that's really been a dumpster fire for the last 15 years. So you got to think, if he falls behind this year, doesn't get the technique work he needs, and the confidence gets a little eroded because of everything that goes on, and probably doesn't do as well in practice as he wants to do, then a year from now he's struggling and battling to just stick on the roster. I could see him being a guy that in year two or three gets cut because he hasn't progressed enough, and that team is in such a disaster mode that they're always trying to sign all these big free agents and they're blowing up their roster and salary cap, that he ends up going somewhere else to a place where they have a veteran or line coach like a Mike Munchak or a Harry Heemstead, and they let the guy sit for a year, even if it's on the PR now that they have all those exemptions, and develop the talent. Smart kid, athletic, big, strong, and I could see him blossoming with that second team. Whereas in Jacksonville, especially with this year, the way they're not getting off-season instruction, kid from a small school like that's going to have a hard time really carving out a role for himself in my eyes.
Yeah, that makes total sense. You know, my last guy is going to be Evan Weaver, the linebacker out of Cal with the Cardinals. You know, he's got Jordan Hicks in front of him, and Hicks is a guy that probably, you know, maybe down the line, you know, Hicks is getting to a point where when you look at his career, he'll be a little long in the tooth in a couple of years for a linebacker, but linebackers can stick around to their mid-30s. So, you know, if Hicks is going to still be sticking around, you've got Devondre Campbell on the other inside linebacker, but I think that you'd probably want Weaver where Hicks is.
Yep.
You know, so that's kind of a sticking point there. And Weaver's kind of that guy who really diagnoses well, very good in the passing game, someone who is just plays with a high level of intensity, but not super athlete, but a guy who can read fast and get to where he needs to fast. And I could see where maybe with Arizona, it just doesn't work out where, you know, in terms of timing, they decide that they like what Hicks is doing. They keep him, and they end up letting Weaver go. And then Weaver ends up sticking somewhere else and getting a chance to move in and actually be a starter.
And, you know, it makes sense because if you look at Arizona in their history there, especially defensively, they've had a lot of guys that were really good players in college, really productive guys, but that didn't test particularly well, weren't phenomenal athletes. And within a year or two, they found a way to replace them with, quote unquote, better athletes. And those guys go elsewhere and become productive. I mean, this to me, Weaver's a guy that, send him to Baltimore, send him to Pittsburgh,
yeah,
where they're not so worried about what are you vertical, what are you this, can you fill a role? I mean, the Williams kid that's been starting for Pittsburgh now for 2 or 3 years at inside linebacker since the kid from Ohio State broke his neck. I mean,
yeah.
Vince Williams, that's his name, Vince Williams, he's not even a fast athlete. He's a 5'40 guy. I mean, he's a slower yeah. linebacker when you test. But in their scheme, with his instincts, they know what they how to use him. So, yeah, I agree. This is a guy that could get overlooked because especially when you're looking down at backup linebacker, how does he help? He's never going to be a impact guy in terms of running down the field on special teams. He can be solid, but because he's not a blazer, he's always going to be hindered from making those great impact plays. So I could see him being a guy that sort of gets lost in the shuffle in their backup linebacker route, ends up going somewhere else, and carves out a role as sort of a rotational starter, backup guy, can fill in for 3 or 4 games when needed. I agree. He's a perfect guy to pinpoint who could be better on his second team than his first.
Yeah, he's kind of a Marv Lewis guy. You know, yes. Marv Lewis comes back into the league, he'd be the type of guy that would look at him and go, I know this kid can play. Let me get him.
Yep,
you
know, exactly.
So, yeah. So that was fun. You know, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, those are the types of guys that are also a little bit harder to fairly evaluate. Because the guys yeah. that when you watch them, they don't always jump off with their blazing speed or closing ability or ability to pull away when they're running after the catch. But all they do is their smarts and their awareness and their instincts lets them consistently play quicker than what you expect in a small area. And the reality is very few plays in the NFL go for 20 yards or more. So if you're quicker in a small area, a lot of time you can be more productive than guys that are truly faster and more explosive. And those guys who don't have that truly special athletic ability often get overlooked and pushed out, especially by teams that either A, don't have playmakers, or B, are just not particularly well run, and they don't really grind and watch the film of their own players. They just sort of make decisions based on the little things they see in practice, and they don't really do the thorough analysis to determine which guys really are the most productive, not which guys may flash in practice and make 2 plays a day that make us say what it could be. So yeah, 100%. That, to me, that's one of the hard things about guys that are not special athletes that are really good football players.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that, you know, we talk about a lot with quarterbacks, but it fits with the rest of the league. Again, you know, with the rest of the league, it is short area quickness and short and quick processing speed, you know, being able yep. to process what happens in front of you. And it's funny because, you know, the more I do this, the more I feel like if someone said, what's the biggest thing you've learned about scouting when it comes to studying film? And I'd say it comes down to basically 2 things for me, which is players who identifying players who put themselves or their teammates in position to make a positive play. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to make the positive play all the time, you know, but they put themselves or somebody else in a position where a positive play could have been made based on their decision-making, their skill, and their processing speed and reaction time, you know? And I would say
100% agree.
Yeah. And it's like and it seems like a simple statement, but if you follow that as kind of like your compass for your process, you start to realize that negative plays that show up on film or non-splash plays that people's just write off, if you look at it closely enough and you're asking that question, you're starting to see this guy understands football. He understands the nature of the play. He understands the obstacle that was in front of him and what his choices were and what he needed to do. And he actually, then you start to realize, okay, this guy actually, this semi-neutral play or negative play that occurred, he did enough to keep this from being a massively negative play. Or this play, he put his teammate in such a good situation that if his teammate actually did what he was supposed to do, this would have been a big play.
Yep.
And it's just like when you start to ask that question every time you're looking at the tape, the more you start to see that invisible thread that connects all the tangible things that teams get, you know, and teams and scouts oftentimes get really excited about. But like you said, it happens one or two times in a practice or once every four games. And that guy ends up basically that guy and five or six others that you drafted ends up being the reason why you're getting fired, you know, at the end of the day.
You know, it's funny because one of the things you talk about, like, are they in position to make the play? Do they help their teammates make the play? One of the things that all veteran guys have told me for years, and especially from winning programs, that they always like to ask whenever there's a real debate about a player because people are split, and they would always say, okay, guys, do you want to play against this guy? And a lot of the time, that's a great way to look at it, because if the guy's, even if he's not a great athlete, but he's always in the right place, doesn't make busts, you may say, well, we don't want to play him because we're not going to make any big plays. Now, he may not be perfect, whatever, but those guys that occasionally make the game-changing plays on defense or even on offense, the rest of the game, they're either non-existent or they blow coverages because they're so aggressive or whatever it may be. And I really believe that is a part of the thing that what you're talking about there is their ability to help their team be better. When you have a guy that you consistently say, I'd love to play against him, even if he's a guy like, to me, Jadeveon Clowney was always that guy when he first came in the league.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the guys I'm not going to put down and put a big grade on because most of those guys that I'm happy to play against, there's a reason for it. That, what you pointed out is exactly it. Certain guys make their teammates better. Like I look back and look at Manti Te'o. He may not have been a great athlete, but he was a solid guy who rarely made a mistake, did his job. It's like, well, a lot of the time, that's all you got to do in the NFL.
Yeah.
Stay over your feet. Don't make mistakes. Be in the right position. And coaches are happy. They will coach. It's easier for a coach to coach consistency than flashes of greatness and mistakes.
Yeah, because if you have 8 or 9 guys who play that way, you know, and I would say you want all 11, obviously, on the field. But if you have enough guys who play that way, then you are an unbelievably tough team to deal with.
Yep.
Because you're not fooled. You're not giving up big plays. You're forcing the opponent to earn it every down. You're going to have protracted drives. Oftentimes you're going to cause them to make mistakes before you make mistakes. And you're going to wind up with, you know, the beneficiary of turnovers and broken plays and big losses. The best teams I've always felt like the best teams had a core group of guys who did that, you know, 6 to 8 guys who did that. And maybe you had one guy who might have occasionally been a liability, but it was hard to actually put him in that situation to be that liability.
Oh, and just look at New England, what they've done all these years
is
make you go the whole field. Don't give up the 80-yarder. How did they deal with Peyton Manning all those years and not getting killed by him? Because they said, hey, we're fine letting them complete 40 passes, but none of them are going to be over 15 yards.
Yeah.
And we're going to make him drive down the field. And if he misses 2 in a row, our ball's ours. And just nice and easy, don't make mistakes. I mean, look at guys, Mike Vrabel, Teddy Bruschi, they were good players. But anybody who tells you they were special, rare athletes who were dominant in Hall of Fame, they weren't. They did their job exactly right. They never made mistakes. They were always in the right position. That's what this guy Weaver could be if coached correctly in the right system.
Yeah, and another team that beat Manning in the same way were the Seahawks in the Super Bowl, because really, even though they had more superstar type athletes, they also had very resilient, emotionally resilient defenders. The thing I loved about Seattle is there were countless plays where touchdowns were about to be made and the player gets stripped inside the 5. Or the defender knocks the player out inside the 2, and now you have a goal line stand. And it would happen in situations that would deflate other teams, but they were like, as long as they don't score, we have a chance to still win this game. And that team believed that they were within 14 to 17 points of an opponent in the final 5 minutes. And part of that was because of their quarterback, but part of it was because of their playmaking ability on defense, that they had a shot. and that they had more will than their opponent. And part of that was playing mistake-free football and staying focused. And when you looked at Peyton Manning, I remember, you know, the game plan that they had there was like, we're going to make Peyton Manning throw it to Thomas, the tight yep. end Thomas, who did not like contact and, you know, in the middle of the field. And they just roughed him up. And after he dropped some passes early in that game, Manning got impatient and decided, I got to get it downfield because they're giving me this and letting me punish. And they're punishing him. And yep. then, and he went off kilter, and the Seahawks were able to make big plays and they dominated that game.
And see, to me, and we're going on a total tangent here, but
sure.
that is why Brady and Russell Wilson are so special, is they have that patience, that they will sit back and take it and take it and take the 3-yard dump, take the little 5-yard scramble when they have to get out of the pocket without forcing it. Neither one of them is going to be, and not that Peyton Manning wasn't a great quarterback, but he was without question a guy who his thoughts, sort of like Philip Rivers, are how do I make the play?
Yeah.
How do I live to see another down? How do I extend the drive, get 5 yards on 3rd and 4, and then we'll start again? Peyton's not like that. Phillip's not like that. Brett Favre's not like that. And that's what defensive coordinators want. Make them take the whole field, because very few quarterbacks have that patience.
Yeah, and I love this tangent, because like you think about players and what you look at on the film that you can translate also to football character to an extent, on the field character, is what do they do when those situations go wrong? I mean, like, you know, people talk about Russell Wilson and, you know, I hope I don't offend anybody on this show, but, you know, not anybody who's listening to the show, but, you know, he's very much a man of faith and kind of comes across maybe to some people as a bit of a holy roller or a bit of a, you know, maybe a little too on point with everything that he talks about off the field, to the point that he seems a little rehearsed. And when you hear him on the sideline, he comes across that way a little bit too. But when you see how he puts it together on the field, like that Packers game where he comes back and after having a dismal first 3 quarters, he's literally on fire at the end of the game and makes all the difference. But when you see players like that who can like recover that quickly and don't go into a shell, and you see that with them, you know, in college, you see evidence of them where they just don't give up. You know, they're that, you know, I always joke that I thought, you know, there was that game and then there was Russell Wilson in the Carolina Panthers game, like a year later or 2 years later, where they're down like 27-10 and they nearly pull out that game in Carolina for the NFC Championship. And I thought some Nike missed like a great opportunity to have Cam Newton training and have a little Russell Wilson on his shoulder, like basically saying, I'm right behind you. I'm literally breathing down your neck. You yep. know, like I'm coming. You give me time and I'm going to beat you. Like they could have played that up so well and had like a dynamic ad campaign for that, because that was that's the kind of player he is. And you see players like that who just, they will themselves. Like Adrian Peterson back in the day. I remember the Tulsa game. I don't know if you remember this, but there's a Tulsa game where it's 4th and 10, I believe. It was either 4th and 10 or 4th and 12. And it's like, there's like less than a minute left in this game. And they're like not even at midfield. Like they're getting close to midfield. And they hand the ball to him. And he breaks like 3 tackles and takes it the distance. And they're down in this game. And like, he like who does that? Like who gives a guy that ball in that situation, in that deal? Except they knew that this was their best chance. And he had that kind of will that was like, no, I'm not going down. And this is, you know, I'm going to at least get the first down on this play, you know. And I know Tulsa may not be like the toughest opponent in the world.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you know, the two things that are really interesting there is, firstly, when you talk about Russell Wilson, most quarterbacks who have that, I mean, Philip Rivers has that I'm going to fight to the death mentality, but he does it gambling.
Yeah.
Where he's going to push it. He's going to push the envelope. He's never afraid to push it down the field. And hey, if I throw a pick, we'll win the next game. Russell Wilson is going to fight until the death, and he's willing to throw it, but he's never going to put it in a risky spot. Everything he's doing is, how do I be efficient? How do I make sure I give our team a chance to still be in the game the next play? Whereas That's a rare skill to have a guy with ultra competitiveness, but it doesn't make him force plays. And when it comes to Adrian Peterson, whenever I think of anything like that, with that, it just makes me remember back, and this is why Oklahoma did this, is I remember when all the negative stuff happened with Adrian, and he ended up getting in trouble, and people were all flipping out over it. And I remember when he came out of school and talking to people at Oklahoma, everybody to a man there, not only did they love him as a person, but they all to a man said, he is the single greatest person that's ever been here under Coach Stoops. So to hear somebody say that, when they've had legendary players under Stoops, other superstars, for them to say that both at the time and when all the controversy was going on about Adrian, it tells you that this is a principled guy who is going to fight and do whatever it takes for the success of the team. And that's what he is. I mean, Adrian is the ultimate teammate.
Yeah, and it's funny because then you can go two lanes with this, because there's a guy who I thought of as a foil for Adrian Peterson at that position during that time was Jamal Charles. And I remember watching Jamal Charles and thinking, this is that bored kid in elementary school who's like, for fun, is like studying like a physics problem and doing some sort of biology experiment on his own time, but he's getting a C in the class, like that he's like in, because he's too consumed with other things that are well above his pay grade. And when you watch him run, it was like he'd try things that he'd often make, but you're like, that's not going to fly in the NFL as often. And he's going to have to like become more mature. But one of the things that was interesting about him was I remember him, you know, when he announced that he was going to Texas, and he literally told the press in his, as a freshman, I'm going to make Texas forget about Adrian Peterson. And like, you know, when you hear that, you're thinking immature kid who's full of himself, you know? And I remember that was the first thing I heard. And then I kept watching his game over the years. And I was like, well, I'll be damned if he didn't at least divert their attention away from Adrian Peterson.
No doubt.
Like he didn't make them forget, but he certainly gave him a run for his money in terms of the talent and skills that he had. And to me, there's like two types. There's that type who's like, I'm going to talk, but they back it up and they play with intelligence. And you can see that ability's there. Or a guy like last night, I was trying to find something about Nick Chubb in terms of like interviews of other players about him, because I was thinking about working on something about him, but I didn't find anything really. But what I did see was a mic'd up Nick Chubb. This is kind of like this is about a mic'd up version of like NFL films mic'd up of the player. A mic'd up version of Nick Chubb is about as interesting as a mic'd up version of Alan Greenspan on like Vicodin, you know? I mean, like, it's like boring as all get out. Nick Chubb basically said two things in an 18-minute like clip that I listened to on YouTube. One was thank you, and the when somebody complimented him, and the other was something to the effect of like congratulating the teammate who he tipped himself out of the game after they had control of it and let his teammate score, you know. Those were the only two things that guy said. And like he's and it's like he rarely talks, like literally before the game, after the game, on the bench, everyone's talking to him. He's just looking and smiling and nodding his head. He's slapping hands with everybody. It's everyone likes him. You can tell he like talks to people occasionally, you know, but he's like on the field, all you hear is him breathing and grunting and like and playing and when you see that, it's like you see those two opposites. It's like, I'm gonna let my game speak for me, and literally that's what you see. Or the guy who's like, I'm gonna come in here and I'm gonna show you how good I am and then live it up. Like those two guys I can deal with, you know.
Yeah, 100%, no question.
So, you know, that was a fun tangent, but, you know, one other thing that's kind of interesting in terms of studying players that you know, is often talked about is the whole all 22. Do you have to have the all 22? Is the broadcast tape something that's usable? And, you know, I don't necessarily think it's a one or the other. I don't think you do either, but it would be fun to just kind of talk about your views on where each type of angle can be helpful.
Well, firstly, I think there's an enormous value in the TV film because the all 22 is great. Don't get me wrong. To figure out the X's nose, to be able to watch corners, I mean, corners are nearly impossible to watch on TV film. But I think there are so many beneficial things you get if you could. And unfortunately, I don't know of any teams that really intercut them because there is, I think, still, even amongst the younger people in the league, there's a real belief they're not all 22 is the answer all the time.
Right.
And I'm a big believer. Like if I look at quarterbacks, I 100% believe I want to see the play from the TV angle because they focus so much on the quarterback. You really get a chance to – you can see his footwork. You can see his eye movement much better because it's so much zoomed in. I just like that view. And also sometimes when you get that really ground-level view almost from behind the quarterback, you can really see what he's seeing. As opposed to the end zone view, yes, you can see what the defense is doing, but you don't actually know what he can see because you don't have his viewpoint behind the line, the offensive lineman. So I love that part of it. And just like with corners, I love it with corners because although obviously 3 yards after, 3 seconds after the ball snap, they're off the screen, that initial part, especially for defenses that like to press, yes. I want to be able to see that close-up that they do maybe five times a game with the good yes. corners where they close up and they show him right at the line of scrimmage. What does he do with his feet? Is he quick with his hands? Or is he always late with his hands? What is he doing with those little things? And to me, that's so important. So I'm a big believer in the TV film. I don't think you can scout exclusively off it, but I think combining the two is so enormously valuable.
Right. And it's and that's one of those things is that when you look at, you know, to continue with that whole idea of on the perimeter, you look at wide receivers. And one of the things that you miss on the all 22 that you get with a lot of broadcast angles is literally seeing how good their technique is with how they use their hands. Yep. Like because they close that in. How far apart are their arms from their frame when they're catching the ball? Do they put their hands in the correct position? Yep. To track the football, because you're not seeing that to that degree. You're not, you know, with running backs or, you know, with linemen, you're not seeing the footwork maybe as clearly in certain angles as you could with certain close-ups or hand position,
yep.
you know, and being able to, do they land their hands well? Do they flip their hips well? Are they, you know, all the and then the kind of the micro movements, I call it, with certain players. Like there are just small adjustments that players make that aren't necessarily like technically taught, but because yep. of the situation that occurs, you know, maybe Ezekiel Elliott running in, you know, an outside zone play, and he deals with penetration from 2 points early in the backfield, and he has to make a jump cut on the first one and then stick the landing and still have to somehow turn his outside shoulder underneath a defender who's off the edge yep. in the backfield after that and do it in a way where he just makes that man miss. And it's because he did that little thing that turned a like 3 to 5 yard loss into a 7 yard gain. And it's like that kind of stuff gets missed sometimes.
Oh, 100% it does. And I'll add to that where you're talking about like the hand use when they're in press and things like that. And you know, both of us have talked about, both of us believe in the analytics side of this and how it can be an enormously valuable tool. One of the things that I've been hearing and a bunch of people told me is one of the big things that teams are relying on is that when you look at all the different numbers and all the different testing of whatever for receivers, the one thing that they're finding has a pretty strong correlation is receivers in college who are very successful releasing and producing against press coverage have a much higher success rate in the NFL. So if you're going to look at that and you're going to watch all the snaps of them in press coverage in all 22, why wouldn't you want on a receiver, maybe it's only 12 times in a season that they close up, but the close up to really see, because when you see on 22, a corner shoot his hand, sometimes you don't even see if he actually hits him.
Yeah.
Because by the time they turn, you can't tell. Well, if you get some close ups and you can see the hand use, well, is he getting lucky in his release? Or does he really know what he's doing? Or is he beating him strictly on athletic ability? And if we teach him technique, he's going to be even better. So I wonder if those little things and having somebody really analyze those things where you can really get into the nitty-gritty by using the TV tape could really immensely help not only scouting, but the analytics side of scouting, because you could get better at analyzing the things that they're identifying now that correlate strongly with success at the NFL level.
Yeah, and it seems like that there's now, you know, a site, there's a company called Veritone, which apparently, you know, I was reading today that they work with more than 34 sports entities, including the NCAA and college football playoffs, and they typically license footage of individual players to request in NFL teams. And apparently, with the in-person events being canceled by the pandemic, they launched a site called draftclips.com. So they apparently have more than 30,000 collegiate football clips and highlights of over 150 top prospects for the consumers and for NFL draft analysts. So this could be, you know, this could be interesting, because one of the things that they said in the article is that there's different angles that they're capturing from all the feeds, from all the variety of cameras during the games. So there's literally angles that scouts normally haven't seen. So I'm interested to see how much this site costs, because that would be a wonderful tool to be able to have.
Oh, no, just think about it. If you're watching, say, this coming year, you're watching Alabama, most likely, although they're going to have the normal camera feeds, they have so many cameras at the game, I would be stunned if one is not on Devonta Smith every single snap. Or if that means I can go literally watch him in a close-up on every single route, or the Stingley cornerback from LSU, are you telling me that's not valuable? The little things you can see when they're zoomed in on that player? I mean, there's an enormous amount of value. I think you're going to see within 5 years, a few NFL teams are going to start to incorporate TV clips. It may not be from TV, but from the cameras that the TV trucks use, getting that information and having a few new people added to the video departments to try to search out the important plays. Now, a lot of it you don't need, but certain things, and put that into the film. And they'll even have film that may be all 22 and it may be all. And the all will be, we've spliced in the TV coverage or the TV camera angles where we think it's valuable. And I think there is going to be a time when teams start using that. I think it's going to take some open-minded people, because there are some people who believe there is no film but all 22, and that if it's TV stuff, it can't be valuable. But I'm telling you, there is value in that TV film.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, I've made a living doing it. That's all I can say is that, you know, when I didn't have access to all 22 and for years of doing it, there's a lot to learn, and there's a lot that you can see about a player that – and it's interesting, because you'll hear people say, well – you can't find anything on all 20, you know, can't find anything on the broadcast tape. And then you listen to their analysis and I'm going, well, I just saw something, you know, very different from what your analysis says about the all 22. And let's see if that works out. And it has, you know, I mean, the multiple times. So it's one of those deals where, yeah, multiple angles will absolutely help. So,
it's sort of the thing of why not use analytics? I mean, just another tool. Yeah. So why wouldn't extra angles help?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we just live in a polarized society, I guess. I don't know. It's just, you know, we tend to want to be polarized about everything. I think we're raised to think of life as an either or thing. And as opposed to being like, well, it could be both, you know?
Yeah, most things are a shade of gray. There's very little black and white in our world. That's the reality.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, but we want that simple, I guess, and we fight to the death for it. But
yeah, I love simple. I mean,
I do too. But easier. But there are very few of those things, you know.
Exactly.
And they're usually elegant, you know.
Yes.
So yeah. So what about this year? I mean, what are you hearing in terms of, you know, where we're headed this year? It seems like from, you know, you've heard the announcements that college football is trying to get back on track, that they're going to have players show up on campus and there's probably going to be practices, and the NFL is being diligent about trying to, you know, they seem to be taking this methodically in terms of what they're going to do, how they're going to do it. They're not making any promises about anything, but it seems like they're heading down the road that this season is going to start. There's lots of states that seem to be open to the idea of playing, whether they're having fans on an adjusted level or whether they're just not going to have fans at all, but they're open to like sports returning.
Yep.
I kind of joked, you know, I would say sardonically to the point of saying, well, there might be light at the end of the tunnel, but I think that light might be a freight train. but what, you know, what are we really facing here? You know, in terms of what maybe you're hearing internally.
Well, there's a few things. I think the most interesting thing to me is the difference between the college and the pro game, because one person did mention to me, and it just, as you were talking, it reminded me of what he had said. He said, Russ, he said, here's what I think is going to happen. He said, most college football programs will start up. He said, they'll probably get through fall practice without any issues. But he said, the problem is the campuses, when they open, they're going to be campuses that get swamped by this disease and have students die, and they have to say, we're shutting down. So based on what the NCAA said, if you don't have students, you can't have games. This guy thinks there's going to be three or four major schools that a week or two into the season are going to have to say, we are out.
Yeah.
And we can't play. Well, if that happens, do the rest of the teams have to do that? Are the conference, what are the laws within the conference? I mean, there's so many tie-ins. So for the college game, I just don't see how it can survive the season, because they're going to be, unless, you know what, and we say that, we're making both of us the presumption that it's going to come back. Hey, I think we're both rooting that as things open up, things go well, and we can all quote Trump and say, you know what, he was right. It was just going to go away. And I think we all would love that to happen, because that'd be the best thing for our country. It'd be great for people that would never have to die. But I think you have to plan for the worst case. And the worst case is colleges open up, kids are back on campus, and some of the big campuses, like in Arizona State or a Columbia, just get swarmed by this thing. And they have to shut down the campus. That means you have to stop playing sports. What do you do? So for college, that's a big one. For the pros, the two things I heard that were interesting is one guy with the team told me, he said, Russ, he said, we have no idea what the league wants to do. But he said, the idea a bunch of us nobodies with teams, he talks like most of them do with a lot of executives of the teams. And he said, what a bunch of us nobodies keep talking about is there going to be a plan where basically – these guys think this is going to be what happens. They said they haven't heard from the league, but this is their assumption is every player, every staff member, every coach, every person that walks in the building every day will be tested in the parking lot before they're allowed to enter the facility, and they will have to wait 30, 40 minutes, an hour until the results come back. And he believes it's going to be when you arrive and when you leave every single day. And he said that's the only way this group of people – now, they're not decision makers. They're middle-range executives. But they've all talked about that is what they think the solution is going to have to be, because you're talking about enormously valuable assets in the players, the coaches. So to not be precautious is crazy. And the other thing, and this is the one I mentioned to you right before we got on the air, is many of the sports are starting up. Many of these athletes are so young and in such great shape that there's a good chance they will be able to get through training camp and get to the season where things are okay. But as one person with the team mentioned, he said, one person, there's a good chance, is going to die from this disease that is a professional athlete that contracts it at a facility. And he said at that point, he really believes you will see pro sports and even college sports shut down until there's a vaccine. Because you cannot, if you're a player that is making millions a year, you cannot put your life and your future earnings on the line for one season.
Yeah. No, it makes no sense. And the odds are, I mean, you just do the math, you know, the number of players that are in the league, and the math would tell you that there will be one player, you know, 100%. At least one, you know,
and also just think about it. Most 22, 23 year olds are arrogant about staying healthy, not arrogant as people, but I'm saying they believe they're invincible. They're not worried. Multiply that by 400. Cause if you play in the NFL, you are an alpha male.
Yes.
Even the guys that aren't that tough are alpha male. So they don't think they're going to get sick. And if they're feeling a little sick, they think it's just a cough and a cold. They're not even going to worry about it.
That's
so
right.
So it is going to spread, just like coaches the same way. Most coaches in football are alpha males, and they have that sort of mentality of whatever it takes. So it's a terrible group to bet on not transferring this, because they don't worry about these things. So I just think – any professional sport, but I think football and hockey especially, where that alpha male sort of, and even basketball, where that macho alpha male, I'm the top dog sort of attitude, we're going to hit, we're going to be physical, I can out-tough you, that attitude is going to cause it to spread. Whereas baseball, they could probably get away because it's just not that type of sport.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know, obviously it's a hint of caution, and I think it's a good way for us to look at that and approach it. And, you know, this was a fun conversation. It may have been ended on a little more realistic, reality-based note of the times that can be a little bit of a downer for some folks. But please, you know, if you're feeling a little down about that and wondering about the season, you know, the perspective of the real perspective here is that, are you healthy? Are you taking precautions? Are you making sure that you're caring for the people around you, even if you're feeling well, so that, you know, other people who are more vulnerable, don't contract anything. You know, please make sure to do that. I mean, certainly it's just respect. You know, I've kind of talked about it in the past. It's like, you don't drive on a highway where construction's been going on and go 85 miles per hour, you know, when the sign says slow down to 45 or 35 or even 50, you know, wearing a mask is basically doing that. You know, that's all you're trying to do is show some respect for other people. And it's a slight inconvenience, you know, so.
And the other thing I'll say is both of us want to see sports this year. And we're both very hopeful that it's here. I think we're just throwing out, hey, there's a chance it may not be. The one thing I do feel confident is, even if it's not here this year, it isn't going away. These are part of our life and culture within the United States. And if it means a year off, and that's what it takes to keep everybody healthy, and then a year from now, when hopefully there's a vaccine or at least a flu shot type thing that lessens the chances of it, then sports will return and we can all rejoice. But the most important thing to realize, we all want it back. Matt and I couldn't be more excited and hopeful that it is back. But we're just trying to pose that realistic thought that you don't know, nobody knows, even the smartest people in the world, which we are both far from, the smartest people don't know. Right. This is unpredictable. And that's what we're just throwing out there.
Exactly. And it's just a matter of, again, having that perspective to understand that, you know, we're talking about lives. You know, and we, while this is our livelihoods, these are our livelihoods, football is, it's also, and it's entertainment. It's entertainment sphere. And, you know, we can worry about our own personal things with that. But when it comes down to the many, you know, this is one of those rare cases where you have to think about the many.
Yep.
You know, and so I hope you guys are doing that out there. We, as always, have enjoyed being able to talk with you or have you, you know, talk about the NFL draft, talk about scouting. You can find Russ Landy on Twitter at Russ Landy. You can find me at Matt Waldman. And of course, the Rookie Scouting Portfolio is available for download. If you have fantasy drafts, highly recommend you check it out at mattwaldman.com. And we hope you guys have an awesome weekend as we head into summer here.